best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we learn about fossils of dinosaurs found in New Mexico that provides evidence that they were quite diverse and thriving before their extinction. And we learn about a series of forums looking at what challenges rural schools are facing in New York State. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Remember as a child dreaming of a world where dinosaurs roam free with humans? Well, that is not such a far-off idea. Fossils found in New Mexico represent some of the last dinosaurs that lived in North America before their extinction. It possibly settles a debate in the paleontology world that dinosaurs were struck down out of the blue, rather than being an already dwindling species, and the asteroid was the final blow. It shows that before the 6-mile asteroid hit Earth, dinosaurs were a very diverse species based on region, therefore indicating that they might not have been declining before the asteroid hit, rather thriving. To learn more, I spoke with Andrew Flynn, an assistant professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at New Mexico State University.
Yeah, so in the rock record, the extinction of the dinosaurs and their associated friends is essentially instantaneous. It's they're there in one layer and they're gone in the next, right? And so the public actually has a much better understanding of this mass extinction than almost all the rest of them, because it's so famous and it's the most recent one, right? And so it looks, the best evidence is that this is a massive asteroid impact in the Yucatan Peninsula that, you know, we don't know if it's months, days, years, decades, but geologically it's instantaneous and they all go extinct.
So people who studied the end of the dinosaur species studied into regions with what they called fossil-rich lands, and I guess that's like modern-day Montana and Wyoming. So could you tell us, what did they find there? And I believe it is made that some sort of case that it is less biodiverse landscape than in those eras. So could you just explain why is that?
Yeah, okay. So to like a little bit of background, is the very last part of the age of dinosaurs, the Cretaceous period, is something called the Maastrichtian. And so the preceding period is called the Campanian, and the Campanian is really rich dinosaur faunas all over North America. Every area has different dinosaurs. It's sort of a high watermark of dinosaur diversity. Coming into the very end of the age of dinosaurs and the end of the Maastrichtian period, we don't have as good a record. And it's really from... until our research, there was really only one place in West North America with excellent fossils. That's one thing. And you have to have really good age control on your rocks. You have to know how old they are. And so you need both of those things to really understand the patterns. And so what you see in this place in Montana, Wyoming, called the Hell Creek Formation, these are probably dinosaurs that a lot of people are very familiar with. They are very famous. Things like Tyrannosaurus Rex, Triceratops, like that's where these dinosaurs come from. Jurassic Park highlights a lot of these animals, right? And so it's an amazing place to work, and it's an incredibly rich dinosaur record, but it's one place in the world, and it's hard to draw a lot of conclusions. And so from just one data point, and what it seemed to show in the Hell Creek is maybe there's a little bit of decline in dinosaur diversity going into the end of the age of dinosaurs. And is this a widespread pattern? And the idea was that, well, you know, we don't really find that, like, we find some of the same dinosaurs in all over Western North America in late Maastrichtian. That's not true, it turns out, is that these rocks in New Mexico, which have been collected for over 100 years, these are not like new dinosaur fossils, but they have new ages on them now. And so previously they were considered to be 70 million years old, which is around 4 million years before the end of the age of dinosaurs, 66 million years ago. And so now we're able to show that they are from this last like tiny sliver of time, like this geologic time, this last few hundred thousand years before the impact. And they have really different dinosaurs.
So it seems that later on in the 1900s, paleontologists studied areas like New Mexico, like you mentioned, and even Texas. So what did they start to find there? And notably, what was found, and hopefully I pronounced this right, the Dinazin Wilderness Area?
Yes, Dinazin.
Which is south of Farmington, New Mexico. So what was going on there?
Yeah, so historically, paleontologists go to this Dana's of Wilderness area and this place called Alamo Wash, and they started finding dinosaurs. And so the major one they found was this 100-foot-long, 35-ton-long-neck sauropod dinosaur, something sort of for reference is roughly the same length as a 737 and weighed about the same as 5 or 6 full-grown African elephants. Right? So these are huge animals. And there's other dinosaurs there too. There's these horned dinosaurs that look a lot like Triceratops, but are a little bit different. They have duck-billed dinosaurs, but they are a different kind. They're ones with the big crests on their heads. And they also found, you know, some things that are common with Hell Creek. Tyrannosaurus rex is found, and Tyrannosaurus rex is found everywhere in the Late Cretaceous. It just is sort of, it managed to go everywhere, down into Texas too. And so Texas has very similar fossils. And so the idea was that, well, these are really different than the stuff in North Dakota and Montana. Well, they're not the same age, because they can't be, because they just don't have the same things. And so, well, they must be older. And so the real complication in New Mexico is that we are actually missing that perfect layer of white clay that has like all the impact markers. It just isn't there. It's been eroded away by some process prior to preservation. And so that's what required a lot of new techniques from us to really get ages on these rocks to show that these dinosaurs are really different and they are the same age as stuff further north.
So I feel like age is really the question here. So with all this research and findings, how did you conduct your study into this all, especially finding what you found in New Mexico?
Yeah, so we got the age of the rocks two different ways. So like all science, like having two different methods line up and give you the same answer gives you really good support that you're on the right track. And so the two ways we did this is first, there are certain types of crystals that trap potassium in their structure. They're called feldspars. And some of that potassium radioactively decays into the element argon. And we actually know how long it takes for half of that to happen, something called a half-life. And so we were actually able to measure some of the argon ratios within some of these crystals to get at how old those crystals were since they were erupted from a volcano. So we're not actually getting an ash. We don't really have any ashes from a volcano. What's happened is that these were erupted, and then the river system that this whole area is recording reworked those into a sandstone at a river and deposited that. And so the dinosaurs are actually entombed, most of them, in this same sandstone. And what these crystals do is give you the oldest possible age for that rock. Those crystals have to have already existed if that rock was being made of them. And so those ages came back at like 66.4 million years ago, which is really great evidence that these are latest Cretaceous, like very end of the age of dinosaurs. So we also used something called magnetostratigraphy, paleomagnetism, to get a second line of evidence. So Earth's magnetic field is not perfectly stable, nor does it always have magnetic north in the northern hemisphere. Occasionally, the magnetic poles will actually reverse or flip. And so your compass would point south instead of north. And we're fortunate in sort of the magnetostratigraphy space that the age, end of the age of dinosaurs actually happens during one of these flips. So it's easier to record. And it actually is a very short amount of time represented. So we actually know when these flips happen. And so if we can find them in the rock record, we can actually say, well, this layer then is at this age. And that actually gives us an even tighter age control that is the last 300,000 years of the age of dinosaurs.
So when I was reading the research article, I thought it was interesting that you were just talking about magnetism, because it was called an unusual ally. So I'm curious why it was an unusual ally in the sense.
Oh, man. I don't know who wrote that one. It's a good ally to have, right? Because it's people don't really think about Earth's magnetic field. Like, you know, you have your compass, or maybe you're like, think about like it helps your phone orient itself, things like that. But you don't necessarily think about it if you're not in geology or your geochronology, being able to use that to tell us how old rocks are. And so it's a totally separate way of getting this. It's totally independent of the actual crystal dating, and both of them arrive at the same answer, which is, you know, really good evidence that we had the correct age for these rocks.
So I would love to know more about your time on sites collecting fossils. Like this is something I'm really interested in knowing.
So for this exact study, we actually, most of the fossils we're working with are previously collected, but over that whole project we did tons of fossil collections. And so I think one of the articles talked about digging holes, and so we do a lot of digging holes. And in terms of finding fossil bones, the public has a bit of a misconception. We don't dig out whole hillsides hoping to find a bone. What we actually do is usually they're actually kind of exposed on the surface, and that gives you an idea, oh, we should dig here, we should dig here. And, you know, that's how we normally do it. These animals are quite large, so finding small fragments of them on the surface, if you're in the right area and the right beds of rock, are actually not super difficult. But finding whole, complete bones is really rare. And so we care a lot about that. And then we work a lot with fossil plants as well, which requires digging out different units of rocks, kind of understanding the geology and figuring out, well, where were plants probably living? Where were they going to get deposited? On the geochronology side of things, like, that is more traditional geology measuring with a, these are tools that people collecting in the 1800s would have totally recognized almost everything we're using. There's no, the wilderness area has no motor vehicles, no pack animals, nothing. It's all by foot, all by hand. If we have something really big we need to get out, you have to helicopter it out. And so we're going out to all these sites, we're hiking, we're digging with pickaxes and shovels and measuring the thickness of rocks with essentially sticks that we mark out how, we know that we have a known distance on the sticks, the different marks, and we can actually sight in how thick the rock beds are. And so it's fairly, I wouldn't say low tech, but it's a fairly conservative way of doing things. And it's great because we're out in a remote part of the world, so it's hard to, we bring a lot of technology, it doesn't always work well.
I'm curious, can you recall a time that you are on a site or you know, doing research and you found something that particularly stood out to you that you were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I found this or my team found this or anything like that?
I don't know about finding. I remember the first time I went out there, we were hiking for a while and I sat down. I thought it was a petrified tree, which are pretty common out there. And I was like, oh, it's a little different. And the Tom Williamson at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science, the co-author on the paper, like, was like, you should stand up. And it turns out actually the femur of one of these big dinosaurs. And it's huge. It's like tree trunk size. I just had sat down on it. I wasn't even thinking. He's like, you shouldn't do that next time. Like, don't sit on them. But yeah, we also find lots of a cool, like, it's just a cool place to work. And the fossil plants are pretty amazing. I do a lot of fossil plant work. And so they're really diverse and really different in the after the extinction. We have not found any plants before the extinction. So we're missing that record there. And we don't have any animals just after the extinction, but we have tons of plants. So like, we want to find both. So yeah, and it's just a, I don't know, I'm very lucky to be able to do what I do. I get to do like every 7-year-old's dream. So like a 5-year-old, I don't know, old kids are into dinosaurs now, but yeah. So.
Yeah. So you said you specialize in fossil plants. So what are some of those plants that you look for?
That's tricky because we don't know most of them what they are. It isn't like animals. Like, it's harder to identify plants to modern groups, especially just from the leaves. But the plants that we find right after the extinction are dominated by sycamore trees. So plane trees, people see those all the time. They have the pretty white bark and the big leaves. Those are everywhere, not just in New Mexico. It's all over Western United States. And then other like things like magnolias and laurels are sort of the really common parts of the plant life in this part of the world. And the just after the mass extinction of the dinosaurs.
So with the research, it states or it kind of shows that dinosaurs from the Southwest and dinosaurs from the Badlands in the North are different. Like the regions, they're just different in some way. So I'd love for you to tell me what those differences are, what the types, I mean, were there like communities? Like, think about us today, like as people, was it similar in that way?
Yeah. So it's very similar in that respect. So we call them bioprovinces. Think of them more as like associations of animals. And so in the North, you have your Triceratops, your T-Rex, and something called Edmontosaurid, which is a big duck-billed dinosaur. That the same day we published in Science, they also published a paper about duck-billed dinosaurs. It's been like a nice tie-in. But you have this province in the North, T-Rex, Triceratops, and Edmontosaurus. It's a coastal plain. It's fairly high elevation or high latitude today. It's fairly high latitude in the Cretaceous. In the South, you have different things. You have this big long-necked sauropod, Alamosaurus. You have crested hadrosaurs or crested duck-billed dinosaurs, which are different. You have different horned dinosaurs. You have similar predators. T-Rex is found in both places. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that are just different between the two. And what's important is that these differences are present in earlier in the Cretaceous period during sort of the high water mark of dinosaur diversity. The same provinces are there. They continue all the way up until the end of the age of dinosaurs. And then after the mass extinction, the mammals in the South are very different than the mammals in the North. And so these provinces are there the whole time. So this really leans credence that like the diversity of dinosaurs across North America was probably very similar in both periods, or at least they weren't in sort of terminal long-term decline. They weren't doomed like going into their extinction. So they are thriving, is what we said in our paper. So, and what seems to be really driving this is climate. And so the climate in the South is just warmer. And so certain dinosaurs, especially sauropods, the big long-necked guys, they don't tolerate cold weather. Apparently, they don't like it cold. And so they only live in places that are warm. And so that gives really good evidence that like climate plays a really important role in the distribution of these animals, just like it does today. This is not like a unique part of the Cretaceous. Today, climate plays a huge role in where animals and plants are found. And so this is a deep time sort of evidence for climate being a really important factor in sort of where animals and plants live.
So due to the diversity of dinosaurs from, you know, different regions, this leads to the conclusion that possibly they weren't declining, like you said, like that was previously believed that they possibly were like on their last breath or already kind of dwindling. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, do you believe that to be true with this new research? And do you think that they were still declining at some rate or maybe not? I don't know.
Ooh, I personally don't think they were declining. They seem to be doing great. I think what this really highlights, the work we just did, is now we have two data points in Western North America, and that's it. That's like the whole world. That's pretty much the only really good ones that we have. You need both an excellent fossil record and really good ages on the rocks. I think what this highlights is that we just need more data, right? Like, these are not fossils that people didn't know about. We've known about them for a long time. And so highlighting areas that like, hey, we have these fossil assemblages. Now, you know, places like Texas, the Big Bend part of Texas, has rocks of similar age, but the age control just isn't as good. And so we don't know, are they the same age? Are they a little bit different? And this is North America, and then highlighting worldwide, right? And so I know there are efforts in Patagonia, in South America, there are efforts in China, actively in Europe, of rocks of similar age. And we're hoping, I think we'll have a much better picture in the next 5 to 10 years of like this really important period in Earth's history. And it's people are really interested in it in general. Like the public support, public interest in this has been pretty outstanding.
So do you think if it were not for the asteroid, do you think that there's a possibility that they could have lived for, you know, hundreds of thousands or more years, or even, you know, thinking about today, we could have even seen some roaming around. I know that birds are technically considered dinosaurs, right? I'm talking about like, you know, the T-Rex or those big guys that we know.
Yeah. So absolutely. I mean, you mentioned birds, and in some ways, the age of dinosaurs never really ended because birds are more diverse than any mammal. They're way more diverse than mammals. There are more bird species than there are mammal species, but we talk about the age of mammals because they're just the bigger things on the landscape. Absolutely. They could have gone on to continue to dominate Earth. I mean, they are dinosaurs, like are always kind of poked at as sort of a failure, but they're really not. I mean, they dominated terrestrial ecosystems as the big land animals for, you know, over 150 million years. Right? That's a really long time, or it's like almost 150 million years. And so more than twice as long as since the extinction. And so they are an incredibly successful group of animals. And I definitely think that without calamities like this, I'm not saying there couldn't have been one later on that knocks them out or something like that, but there's no evidence that they were, in my mind at least, sort of doomed to extinction.
Andrew Flynn is an assistant professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at New Mexico State University. The research was originally published in the journal Science. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Rural schools in New York State are facing challenges. The Rural Schools Association of New York supports and advocates for smaller school districts all across the state. Executive Director David Little is making his way to communities all across the state to host Rural Schools Forums. WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley spoke with David to learn more.
The idea of the forums is to gather information from across the entirety of the area. not just schools that we represent, but we know that rural schools and their communities are intrinsically intertwined. And those communities that host the school recognize that it's usually their largest employer. It's the cultural, the not only the educational, but the sports center, the emergency center. They're all wrapped up together. So when a community has an idea about what it wants to become, or what its challenges and issues are, it typically includes the school and goes beyond the school. And conversely, the school district only exists in the context of the children within the community. And so you want the two to be supporting each other to understand each other's problems. So the issues forums are intended to hear from the school community, teachers, administrators, school board members, parents, students. We want them all to tell us about what's going on there. But we also want to hear from higher education that's in the area, from business leaders, from local officials or state representatives in the area. If there's a military presence in the area, in the Fort Drum area or down at West Point, certainly we've talked to the military folks at the same time. And so we take all that information and we put it together into a policy brief that will identify for state and federal leaders what the issues and challenges are and perhaps propose solutions to some of those things.
The state mandate for EV buses, can rural districts actually comply? I've heard debate, you know, that some are moving forward with it, others are saying, no way, can't do it. I mean, what's the status for rural districts across New York?
Yeah, it's not good for a couple of reasons. One, financially, you know, the way that we've set up school funding in this state is that there's a 2% local tax cap. Well, many rural districts don't raise $100,000, $150,000 under that tax cap because they have very little local tax base. So if you have a mandate to purchase a $500,000 bus, even one, you've just used 3 years of your funds under the tax cap, and that's before you've paid any of your inflationary expenses. The state implemented this electric or EV bus mandate in an era where they thought the federal government was going to pay for it. And now it's very clear that the federal government has no interest. And so I think that the state will have to reevaluate. Certainly rural schools can't afford this on their own. And one of the things that has been identified in previous issues forums is that the power folks, people from National Grid and others across the state, have said, we can't do it. We can't get you the power to power all of these buses overnight. We have to recharge the grid. I mean, you look down at, say, Shenandoah, down in the northern end of the capital region, they've got 100 buses. So that's not an insignificant amount of power. When Oliver Robinson, the superintendent of Shenandoah, asked National Grid what it would take to bring them power, they said, you're going to need a $50 million transfer station to get that much power into your buses to do it. That's before you ever put in the charging stations or buy a bus. So the state's going to have to readjust its reality, I think, going forward, either the timeline or the number of buses that you might have to have. And certainly we also hope that the market will change over time and that they will both become more affordable and it'll become more practical to run them in cold weather over mountains.
We're waiting to see the impacts of premium hikes. How concerned are schools about how that's going to impact the health of the children that they're trying to teach and protect?
I think that if that continues, I think that it will be harder for innovative things that have been highly successful, like school-based health clinics. In the southern tier in central New York, the Bassett Healthcare System has a whole series of school-based health clinics where they serve the entirety of the community and predominantly their students. I think the state of New York will have to get more innovative in what it allows. Right now, the school physician, the school pediatrician that comes in largely to do tests and provide immunizations and that type of thing needs to be able to provide a broader array of services because in many cases, that may be the only doctor in the community that's available to those kids. even if some of the federal programs remain and are administered by other departments, they've completely eliminated the data gathering of the U.S. Department of Education. Well, when you do that, you've eliminated the ability of school districts to prove a need for anything because you don't have any numbers. You know, people are extremely concerned because in New York State, the NAEP numbers, the national assessment numbers, went down. Not dramatically, but they declined, right? Well, the only way to prove that we're getting better and the only way to figure out what works to make it better is to be able to assess that through the numbers. And if you don't have those tests and you don't have those numbers, you can't prove it one way or another. And if you can't prove it, then, you know, you can never say that the federal government should get in the business of funding those things again. So I think going forward, the state's going to take an increased responsibility, both financially and programmatically, for what it believes that we need. But I think it'll be increasingly difficult to put that back on the federal government. Even if you were to change administrations, you'd have to build that infrastructure up again from what's being deconstructed.
David, where can people get information about future forums, where they are, when they are?
We're holding 14 in total. And we're going all the way across to Chautauqua County, all the way out on Long Island. And they can go on RSANY, just for Rural Schools Association of New York, even if you just Google that. And on the website, it'll tell you where they all are. Our last one is December 3rd. Absolutely vital. With the exception of Kathy Hochul, in the entirety of my career, we've never had another state official north of the Tappan Zee Bridge that touched public education. And if you look even now, the chairs of both the Assembly and Senate Education Committees are from the city, or Yonkers, right outside the city. And so getting them the information and the perspective of how these state policies and formulas play out in a rural area, which encompasses literally a third of their children, they need to know that.
That was Executive Director David Little and WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley. This interview originally aired on WAMC's Midday Magazine on November 3rd. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1830. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.